Accession number 17576, Reel 2.
But...
tell me a bit about your colleagues on this American squadron.
Yes, and they delightful they were too. Most of them were highly experienced already. Indeed, some, including the squadron commander and one of the flight commanders, had flown from England at the latter part of the Second World War. And many others had fought in Korea. So there was a great deal of combat background on the squadron that I was to serve, which I had not experienced back in the Royal Air Force. They were characters. I recall that perhaps they did not have what the Americans then demanded, an academic background, and indeed some of them, in order to keep their careers going, had to go to night school and get a university degree in order to stand any chance of advancement thereafter. But they were fun-loving men, perhaps not as serious as I found them later, a decade or two decades thereafter, and indeed now. And there was a great social life, which perhaps is not quite so obvious now. By and large, they were very, very pro-British, and they gave me an excellent time as a result of that.
How did their style of flying compare to your RAF colleagues? Were they more cautious? You said they flew by the book a lot of the time.
Yes, they did fly by the book. The book was sacrosanct, and indeed I got myself into a little bit of trouble from time to time by being a little bit too flexible with my interpretation of those rules. Now, that would have not been untoward, perhaps in Germany and the UK, but it certainly was there, and they were strictly bound by every form of regulation, and the regulations were voluminous and very hard to recall in toto. This concerns weather, of course, and it's sad that even in South Carolina and the flatlands and swamps of South Carolina, I believe that our weather limits were a cloud base of 2,500 feet and visibility of 5 nautical miles in order to launch reconnaissance training sorties under visual flight rules. I suspect that we had no such regulations back in Germany or the United Kingdom. Indeed, had we had so, we would not have flown. So they were tied by those. There was, of course, no question of ad hoc combat. We did lose a Voodoo in one such combat with an F-100, I believe, from Myrtle Beach. We were reminded then and there that that sort of thing was definitely not on. Whereas, of course, there was a lot of play of that sort in Germany and the United Kingdom, albeit under some regulations. So regulations were very important to the American Air Force. That said, they were very capable at their weapons. I wasn't on a weapons squadron, but I was well aware of what they were up to. They were very capable within the rules at the reconnaissance game. And particularly, and far more so than the Brits perhaps, they were experts at instrument flying and the airways system.
You mentioned earlier that whereas you in the Swift spotted your targets by sight, you referred to some American system of aiming. Did you have that on the Voodoo?
Yes, we did. We had a scope in front of us into which we could peer, which isn't a very good idea if you're firing at very low level, but of course they weren't because of their regulations in amongst the trees of the Sauerland in Germany. But you could look into this scope and you could run the target down reticules within this scope and thereby get the target precisely where you needed it.
This is a radar representation?
No, it's not radar. It's an optical system, which, with a matter of prisms, showed you where the target was in relation to your cameras. I personally think that we could have done without that, and I believe that many Americans didn't use it very conscientiously, particularly in oblique photography. However, the Voodoo did have split vertical cameras in their vertical stations, so that we could take photographs from medium and high level. And indeed, we did do some of that work. I went out to Nevada to carry out a mapping exercise at some 30,000 feet, if I remember correctly, attempting to get some 10 parallel lines for the mapping of a large piece of desert. That, of course, didn't have much application in warfare, particularly in the central region, where to start with, we would have been extremely vulnerable at those heights, and secondly, we were unlikely to get the completely clear weather that would be necessary for that sort of role. But for peacetime use, the Voodoo could do that job, and I did some of it. And then, of course, the view scope was absolutely essential, but not essential for oblique photography.
Did you fly any other American types while you were over there?
Yes, I very sensibly, in order to get acquainted with the American procedural systems, I did some 2 months on the T-33 at Randolph Air Force Base, San Antonio. This was invaluable for that primary purpose, and also just to get to know the terminology and the ways that the Americans operated.
So how long did you spend in America altogether?
Some 2.5 years, the latter weeks being devoted to air-to-air refueling, which was in its infancy in the United Kingdom, and indeed I don't know whether at that stage any operational squadrons were capable of regular in-flight refueling. But I imagined that if I could get this qualification, it would stand me in good stead when I got back to Britain. And I did some of this in the Voodoo. My peers and colleagues, of course, were very well familiar with this business. It wasn't difficult, except that the KB-50, with 4 turning and 2 burning, was not an ideal tanker. I recall that we started refueling at 29,000 feet, the KB-50 already starting to descend to give us the very minimum speed that we could air refuel at. I seem to think that was about 220 knots, and that we would have to take on our fuel before we got down to 28 or 27, and it had to climb up again to give us the speed we needed. So the KB-50 wasn't ideal. The KB-97 that came in was better, and of course there are no such problems now. And we did this sort of thing both day and night, and indeed in some poor weather conditions.
I guess the KB-50 was the tanker version of the Super Fortress, wasn't it?
The B-50, yes.
The KC-97 was the tanker version of the Stratocruiser.
Correct.
Wasn't it? And the KC-135, the 707, was that around at that time?
No, it wasn't.
No.
Well, it might have been, but it wasn't where I was.
Not where you were. No.
But interestingly, on this air refueling business, although I did my training in the latter stages, had I done it earlier, on one of the many weekend cross countries that I did in order to boost the flying hours of the squadron, and flying hours were terribly important to the Americans, even more so than they were to the Brits, who were sometimes, depending on the squadron commander, obsessed by them. But in order to build up these flying hours, as a bachelor, I was often invited to take a RF-101 or indeed the two-seater B model away for the weekend to wherever I so chose, and that frequently was Las Vegas. But on the way,
Nellis, I suppose.
I would go to Nellis, of course, with the rest of the Air Forces. But I could have, had I been air refueling qualified, have called up on a certain frequency to see whether any of the Guard tanker units were available, had fuel, and with standard procedures, as always, connect with them and pick up fuel rather than landing to refuel on my long-distance trips.
Now, the Guard were the Air National Guard, who were the weekend flyers.
Indeed, yes.
Yeah. Mm. Now, you came back from America in 61, was it?
1961, yes.
Yeah. And took up ABC duties at that time, did you?
Yes, indeed.
I didn't stop
flying for a bit, and that was the reason that I accepted the job. Ah. Although, of course, my master had to accept me at the same time. I was very disappointed to be appointed to ADC duties, having just completed my third operational tour, and with the American experience behind me, I thought reasonably that my experience should have been better used in another appointment back in the United Kingdom. The ADC duties would not and did not take advantage of that experience. However, the duty to which I was assigned was at the Central Fighter Establishment, West Raynham, Norfolk, to be ADC to the Air Commodore Commandant. I liked the idea simply because I could continue flying with his blessing, and he gave it, on no less than five different sorts. We had the Hunters of the Day Fighter Combat School there, and I became a supernumerary member of that unit. We had the Air Fighting Development Squadron, which had Lightnings and Hunters. We had number 85 Target Facility Squadron, which had Canberras, and I flew those. We had a station flight, which had Ansons and Meteors, and I flew both of those. So I didn't stop flying, and that should bode well for my appointments to follow. In addition, the tour was worthwhile because I could keep abreast of all the tactics and techniques which were being evaluated and developed by the staffs and their flying units at West Raynham. We moved to Binbrook halfway through, and that was interesting enough. And, of course, I was able to watch great men at work, which itself should be useful later. So I didn't despair of this ADC duty, particularly since it didn't, in my case, involve very much of a social role, as it did in so many other ADC duties.
Tell me a bit about ADC duties. They tend to have a bit of a ceremonial flavour to them, is that?
Well, as I've just suggested, this is often the case.
Yeah.
And it was the least attractive aspect of the job. Fortunately, I'd been told that very little of it existed in the job that I was going to do, and indeed that proved to be the case. But elsewhere, particularly if you were ADC to a commander-in-chief or the chief of the air staff, you would be right, and there would be a great deal of ceremonial and socialising to go with it. I had little or none of that.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But you said, nevertheless, it gave you a chance to see great men at work.
Indeed.
Yeah. Mm. And that occupied 2 years, was it?
Yes, it was too long. During that time, I was promoted to squadron leader, and I'd hoped that that would get me away from there, because although it was pleasant and useful in many respects, I wanted to get back to the front line, and I thought promotion would do that. And eventually, of course, it did, via a staff appointment, an interim staff appointment, in the headquarters at Steamer Point in Aden.
Was that at the towards the tail end of British occupation there?
Yes, it was. Although I wasn't there for the death throes, I did sense and begin to be part of the operations which preceded our departure. And indeed, on New Year's Eve of 1963-64, I went to the 1st O Group with the Army, and indeed the Navy, to decide how we would tackle the growing ferment in the Radfan.
Mm-hmm. But, I mean, the operational duties of the RAF then were presumably keeping the rebels at bay and so on, was it?
Yes, but of course the rebels were becoming increasingly restless, and the terrorists were active even down on the base at Camaxa. I seem to remember that a bomb was thrown in the airport building at about that time.
You had presumably a very circumscribed kind of life there. You had to have escorts, did you? You had to look after your security?
Well, I suppose we were very conscious of it, but at that stage, and I'm sure it changed later, we took very few overt precautions. We were just very sensitive to what might happen, and we would avoid certain areas at certain times which might be threatening. But I don't know. Certainly we didn't at that stage have escorts or protection of any particular sort.
Presumably, as the resistance movement developed, the guerrilla activity became more urban, and therefore they didn't organise themselves in convenient locations where you could strike them from the air.
Well, I'm sure that's true, but I'm getting a bit out of my depth now. As I've said, I was there only in the early stages of this sort of problem. It did get very much worse, and I can't speak of that. We were laying plans for what eventually did materialise, and I was part of that. But I didn't experience it myself, because I think I was only there for some 4 or 5 months in the end.
Then back to flying in 64.
Yes, and a completely different experience at Royal Air Force Chivna, where I had trained on the earliest Hunters, the Mark 1s, with instructors of various levels of experience. And one of the things that I recall fairly vividly when I look back on the whole of my 37 years is the lack of experience that we had when I first joined my operational squadron, that was because, of course, of the vast and rapid influx of both crews and new aeroplanes as a result of the Korean experience. When I got back to Chivna this time, the levels of experience were significantly higher, and I was to command a squadron, number 234 Reserve Squadron, number 1 Squadron at Chivna, which had a very large number of very experienced pilots, and they were looking after a perhaps more select bunch of students than was the case when I first went through, and we were having to man the growing squadrons with such rapidity. So we could expect high standards. We had the staff to achieve those standards, and I was very happy with that in what was now a combined air defence and ground attack orientation to the Hunter Force. You asked earlier whether we had had ground attack. That was not true in the earlier days of the Hunters, but now we were well equipped with SNEB rockets, the guns were firing well, and 1,000-pound bombs to do the ground attack role, and not to forget, of course, the reconnaissance aircraft, because by now the Swifts had gone, and the Hunters had come in the reconnaissance role with the same camera fit, before you ask, to do exactly what I described earlier. And all these pilots, reconnaissance, ground attack and air defence for the Hunter squadrons were trained during my time down at Chivna.
Because Chivna, I know Exmoor well, and Chivna's always struck me as being an ideally located base, certainly for ground attack. I mean, the terrain, Exmoor and Dartmoor, is very interesting to fly over, I'd imagine.
Yes, it was an ideal base in so very many ways. It was a sucker hole, what we call a sucker hole as far as the weather goes. The weather was often very much better than it was around elsewhere and at other airfields within our Hunter's range. So good weather. Easy approach over the sea, of course, not so easy if you were on the westerly runway, but not bad nevertheless. Instant access to excellent low-flying areas, as you described them, but South Wales, of course, was particularly good because it was difficult to fly over. An excellent air-to-ground range at Pembrey for all forms of weapons delivery. An excellent co-located air-to-air range, using Heartland surveillance radar, literally with over the sea, just to the west of Chivna. No airspace restrictions due to airways that would worry us a great deal. And with the Hunter's range then, and by now, of course, we were flying with certainly the inboard overload tanks, not outboard as far as I can remember, so we could reach our diversions, and there were enough of those at typically Exeter, Broady, places like that. So it was indeed a most excellent base, and we are so disappointed that it was rejected more recently in favour of Valley to do the job that it was doing then, now combined with advanced flying.
Mm-hmm. Now, you were 3 years there. Was that it?
No. Not even halfway through.
Yeah.
Some 7 or 8 months into my command at Chivna, I was asked to go out to Gütersloh again to take over number 2 fighter reconnaissance squadron in place of an officer who had been posted. In fact, it was a flip-flop, and he came over to take over my squadron, and I went back to Germany to resume my fighter reconnaissance career where I'd left off with the Swifts some years before that. And I took over number 2 squadron, which incidentally, with number 3 squadron, is the oldest squadron in the Royal Air Force to fly aeroplanes. Number 1 squadron flew balloons, should you get into that controversy. So, and we have just had our 85th birthday. And I took that over in November of 1964.
You went parachute jumping at one time, didn't you?
Yes.
Why was that?
But that's a long, long way ahead. Do you want me to jump ahead that far?
71. I saw it was... Oh, no, you are. Sorry, I've jumped a line.
Well, it might be worth saying a little bit more about the fighter reconnaissance tour.
Yes.
Much of it has already been said, and the fundamentals don't change. But perhaps I'd like to underline again an area which I don't think we paid enough attention to, which is the in-flight reporting. When I got back to command this squadron, before, of course, I had only been an ordinary line pilot on the Swift squadron, I attempted to tackle those problems of battle management and in-flight reporting more directly, being in a better position to do so, and I hope that we saw some progress in both those areas. But I won't go into it any more than that. The tour with 2 Squadron lasted for 2.5 years. I might perhaps mention another bête noire, which I've already hinted at, because it recurs throughout my career, and that is the hours chasing in the Royal Air Force, which I was so angry about right from the start. I didn't perhaps appreciate at the beginning, when I first heard of hours targets, how counterproductive they could be. But I certainly did as my career progressed, and I heard of certain squadron commanders attempting to improve their image at higher headquarters by putting on maximum overload tanks and flying at high level in order to build up flying hours. This is an appalling waste of taxpayers' money, causes frustration with the pilots, degrades operational training, and is altogether bad. Flying hours do not give much of a measure of operational effectiveness. I don't know how it is today, but throughout my career we had this problem. But I didn't have the problem on number 2 fighter reconnaissance squadron, because I had got all the assets I required, that is the airmen on the squadron, I had the photography unit under command, which meant that I could wield carrot and stick as and when was required and determine my own priorities to try and achieve the hours targets and fully operational training at the same time. Now, I'd just come from a squadron at Chevna, which I described, where we had centralised servicing. That is, the squadron commander had hardly any airmen under his command. They all belonged to another squadron leader with whom you had to liaise to get the number of aeroplanes you wanted in the fit that you wanted when you wanted it. Now, however good the relationship was, you would rarely have everything you wanted in that manner.
They were contractors, in other words.
Well, yes, in the sense they were contractors, but not in the present-day uses of that.
No.
But yes, you're right. And it was the vogue at that time, prescribed by the time and motion men, for efficiency. And I don't doubt that on paper it did look more efficient. And I recall the Phantom Force went through these pains too. But I want to make the point that if a squadron commander has all that he requires to do the job, then he can do it so much better in his own way. And that's how it always had been. And I greatly dislike the centralised servicing. Anyway, back to the hours chasing problem. I had no problem in that sense. I knew what my flying hours target were. And I could achieve them very, very easily with my own integrated squadron. So that was not a problem on my squadron at all. They were still important, those targets, to the staffs, but I could achieve them so easily that it didn't matter. And I was able to achieve them at the same time as running a fully operational squadron. And here again, I'd like to mention a point which could have so easily, and often did later and to other squadrons, get in the way of operational training. And that is the academic competition, obsession, that some within the hierarchy had. If I might mention earlier days, back on the Swift Squadron, we had a competition called Royal Flush. This was the international reconnaissance competition between two TAF, not ATAF, two Tactical Air Force and four Tactical Air Force, between the reconnaissance units within those two formations. On the Swift Squadrons, because it was such an ideal aeroplane with such an ideal camera fit, and because our training was so good, we always featured on the winning side, and frequently we were at the top of the league in individual pilot achievement. And indeed in 1958 I myself was on the two-man Swift team representing the Swift Force, the nation, and 2TAF. And this was carried out at Spangdahlen, the American base near the Moselle. Now it's significant that we were all at one base. All the competitors, the Belgians and the Dutch with the British, against the Americans, and I can't remember whether the Americans had anyone else with them at that time. The German Air Force, of course, hadn't got into its stride at that stage when I was there. Canadians may have played, I don't remember, and the French, as usual, played as visitors. But we were all on one base, and I want to make this point so very strongly. If you must have a reconnaissance competition, your competitors must fly over the same targets in the same weather window from the same base. That is a basis for competition, and I had no argument with that at that time. Now, between the time that time, and always we did well down there, and my return to Gutterslow, which I'm now describing, it was reasonably argued that this was no real measure of the TAF's relative capabilities because so few pilots flew. They were representative of their forces, and they had got there by a process of elimination, competitions on the squadron, and then competitions between the squadrons within the TAF. But too few people actually played for the liking of the hierarchy who wanted to see what the whole force could do, one against the other. So we came into a new competition era in my time commanding 2 Squadron. where every base with reconnaissance units played from its own station. And this meant that they flew over different targets, assigned by the referees, of course, at different times, different ranges, and in different weather conditions. That is no basis for competition.